Good day. Welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Cotillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today I'm pleased to have with us Professor Jeffrey Sachs of Columbia University, and we are going to be speaking about his new book, A New Foreign Policy Beyond American Exceptionalism. Welcome, Professor Sachs.
Good to be with you. Thank you very much.
Professor Sachs, may I ask, what is the primary thesis of your book?
The primary idea is that American foreign policy has become dysfunctional for America and for the world. We are still in thrall to the idea that America is exceptional, the world's sole superpower, the one that doesn't really have to agree or cooperate or follow international rules. As President Trump recently said, we're sovereign, we'll do what we want. And I trace this idea through American history and explain where it came from and why it is so dangerously outmoded today.
Isn't there an argument, though, that the type of ill behavior that you describe by American leaders in the post-1945 period, I believe you use the wording, quote, the inherent right to make and break international rules of the game, unquote. Isn't that what all great power, hegemonic powers do? And isn't it really a sort of American form of naivete to think otherwise?
Well, it may be, but in a nuclear age, in an age of the dangers of mass environmental disruption, in a world of 7.6 billion people, I think it's not naivete to say we had better press for a rule of law and global cooperation and for all of the major powers, and there are several now. This is one of the big points about America not being the only one. We had better reinforce the ideas of the United Nations and a charter and a Security Council and so forth, lest we end up with disaster. So it may sound like naivete to say, haven't great powers always waged wars and behaved like they want? And the answer may be yes, but the stakes have never been higher, and the dangers of that kind of balance or imbalance of power approach, I think, have never been greater.
Can you discuss what you refer to as the, quote, three competing versions of America's place in the world, unquote?
There are three different ideas. I call them exceptionalism, realism, and internationalism. Exceptionalism is the idea that America is just number one. It is the global colossus. We do what we want. Trump is a version of that, although a somewhat unusual version, but a version. The second is realism, or balance of power politics. That says basically powers will be powers. Don't expect good behavior. Be on guard. Keep your military strong. And don't expect the best. And internationalism, which I would put myself in that category, says that we have so many deep, crucial interconnections now. We have such an urgent need to find a common understanding and common ground. We have so many ways to destroy each other and cannot rely on the supposedly realistic, quote, balance of power, that we had better reinforce the admittedly fragile rule of international law and behavior within an agreed charter, the United Nations Charter. So the real idea is a debate that is, I think, rampant among these three views. You find strong proponents of at least the first two, and I hope enough of the third, which I belong to. And my argument is that the first two views, especially the America can do what it wants view, which is understandable from a historical point of view, is really out of date and out of whack now, but it still is perhaps the guiding principle of the country.
You say that Chinese actions in the South China Sea and Russian actions in Ukraine are, quote, responses to U.S. actions, unquote. Which particular U.S. actions are you referring to?
Well, the U.S. is the only global power, military bases all over the world, with troops all over the world, with nuclear capacity all over the world. So from the point of view of any other country, the U.S. is always hovering close by and not in such a friendly way. We have perhaps 800 military bases around the world, and they are in more than 70 countries. When any other country asserts its strategic region or its no-go zone, the United States says, aha, you see how aggressive they are. So China absolutely worries about the U.S. control of the high seas around China through a string of military bases and alliances. China absolutely is trying to expand its naval and military presence. If nothing else, I would say, to ensure that it, as a major trading country, has the ability to repulse any attempt to basically corner China. Russia is a different case, where Russia has been invaded from the West repeatedly in modern history, whether Napoleon or Hitler. It is always viewed Ukraine or even Eastern Europe, therefore, as a kind of protection and buffer from the powers of Western Europe. What the United States has done in the last 25 years since the fall of the Soviet Union is to push the military alliance, NATO, closer and closer to the Russian border. And when, in 2008, the United States proposed that Ukraine actually become a member of NATO, from Russia's point of view, that's something like China proposing that Mexico should become part of a Chinese alliance and expecting the United States to say, well, that's fine, they can do what they want. It wasn't fine for Russia that both Ukraine and Georgia were invited into the U.S. military alliance right on Russia's borders. And I think it provoked a very dangerous and serious counter-reaction that we're still feeling today.
I suppose that without getting on this particular tangent, because your book is about many more things, I suppose it could be argued that in the case of the South China Seas, that it's not only the United States, but other regional countries like Japan, South Korea, Philippines, Singapore, Australia, who are all very concerned, in the case of Japan, more concerned than the United States about Chinese expansion, naval expansion, overflights, etc., the creation of military bases on these islands, etc. So it's not merely American concern. I suppose in the case.
I think that's exactly right, by the way. But it's also the case that the U.S. Has gone out of its way on many occasions basically to say to other powers like China, you're on the other side. We are the ones that are going to call the shots. Even with Obama and the attempt to negotiate a trade deal called the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The stated purpose of TPP was we will be in, we'll get other countries in, and China will be out, and we will call the shots and set the rules. I thought it was rather crude way to put things. Basically, a declaration of who's going to run the show. And to my mind, this is the U.S. style everywhere. In every part of the world, we need to show our military presence, our financial weight. And for many Americans, gee, that's just exactly as it should be. That's our power. We should use it. To my view, it ends up costing a fortune and ends up every now and then in a disaster, a real war, a major conflict. And the idea that more or less we can just continue to manage this way, in my view, is naive. Even when we had the great power realist balance of power of the 19th century, which is what the that middle group, the realists, looked to as their model, the Metternich diplomacy of 19th century Europe, that ended up collapsing in World War I, because balance of power is not a balance, in my view. It is a very unstable, shaky imbalance that eventually leads to some explosion of conflict. And my fear is that in the 21st century, with nuclear weapons everywhere and with significant powers everywhere, it would make 1914, unfortunately, look like a small show. And relying, therefore, on big powers facing off against each other in a traditional way just strikes me as a reckless gamble.
How would or how do you differentiate between Trumpian exceptionalism from the classical historical sort of exceptionalism?
I would say that from 1945 till Trump, we had a an uneasy relationship between a superpower that asserted its unilateral claims of power with a superpower that built an international rule-based system. It was the genius of Franklin Roosevelt that gave us the United Nations, after all. It was several presidents that negotiated major agreements like the World Trade Organization. The United States never completely adhered to the rules that we insisted on and set, but there was always an uneasy relationship where we didn't want to stray too far from global norms and global processes that, after all, the United States had done so much to establish. Things have gotten worse progressively over time, I would argue, especially at the end of the Cold War when the Soviet Union dissolved in December 1991. There was a period of incredible hubris in the United States, marked by the so-called neoconservatives, that said, we are the new Rome. We are the global colossus. We are the sole superpower of the world. Now we can do what we want. We launched wars. We tried to overthrow governments. We got ourselves deeply enmeshed in the violence of the Middle East. I would say that was our cause. We launched unprovoked wars, as in Iraq in 2003, and many regime change operations as in Syria and Libya in 2011. I think it's been a debacle. But even in those moments, there was at least some attempt, though it waxed and waned, to follow international principles. Trump was pretty explicit at the United Nations just recently when he said, I don't believe in this global governance. I'm a patriot. We have sovereignty. We are independent. No one will tell us what to do. I think it's simple-minded, this idea that being sovereign means you don't agree on principles, that there aren't international rules and international law. Trump, in my view, is the most vulgar president we've had in certainly in my lifetime and in modern history. And the vulgarity shows in this contempt for following principles, because this seems to be foreign to his idea of personal behavior as well as his idea of what the United States government should do. He likes the deal. The deal is you rough up your counterparts, you punch them up a bit, you try to trip them up, and then maybe you settle. But the idea is that it's all the deal. And if you follow rules, you're a weakling, you're an innocent, you're a naif. And I just find this extraordinary at a time when the U.S., even if it somehow wanted to, does not have the economic weight, the power, nor the right to dictate global development in this way.
In the book, you cite several times with approval the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. Can you explain to the audience why that is the case?
Niebuhr was one of the great public intellectuals in the middle of the 20th century. And he, as a theologian, viewed public affairs from an ethical and moral point of view, as well as a practical point of view. And his great strength was that he was both a pragmatist in his thinking, but viewed morality not as a nice thing, but as a really practical and helpful guide for action. His thought at the peak of American relative power, which came just after World War II, when we were the only major power that had not been destroyed by the war, after all, and we were in our full technological dominance and our full industrial power, Niebuhr said, this is not so good. This looks good, but this is what leads to hubris and massive overreach. And Niebuhr warned against the idea that America, as this exceptionalist country, should and would be able to tell the rest of the world what to do. So I think he had a lot of foresight, because when he was making these warnings, the U.S. really was very, very powerful, and in relative terms, much more powerful than it is today. In Trump's view, and in the view of the neoconservatives, by the way, the U.S. basically remains that preeminent power. Whereas for me as an economist, I see that the U.S. relative predominance has diminished markedly over time. So what was, in a sense, true as a description at the end of World War II, when the U.S. was the only one standing, and in the early 1950s, when the U.S. was way ahead technologically of the rest of the world, that's no longer the case. But we act still as if it is. We tell other countries what to do. We decide which treaties we're going to agree to and not. We tell other countries, don't tell the United States what to do, because the underlying ideas were so powerful, we should do what we want to do, and quote, what's best for the United States at any instant without being bogged down by all these little powers trying to, or all these little countries trying to weaken us. That, in my view as an economist, is an extraordinarily outdated point of view, and I don't think it was ever right. After all, at the peak of the power, it was Franklin Roosevelt who said, let's have an international rule-based system. He didn't say, now we can do anything we want. Quite the opposite. He created the UN with its charter of behavior. But it's more and more unrealistic as you have other parts of the world, and of course, notably China, gaining in technological, economic, and financial weight.
Although it could be argued that in the case of NIBOR, as well as someone else who you cite with approval, George Kennan, that they both campaigned against and were disproving of Henry Wallace, who I think many would argue was the true heir and not Harry Truman of FDR's internationalist policies.
Truman, exactly, had both sides. Truman is, excuse me, both credited and blamed for, in a way, making the Cold War, credited in the view of, I would say, the mainstream, that he had a realistic view of Stalin, who obviously was a true psychopath, and he had a realistic view of Soviet imperial reach, and he resisted it. So that's the mainstream. And the counterpart is that the United States lost opportunities to find a peaceful resolution well before the Cold War spiraled into an absolutely terrifying nuclear arms race that actually on several occasions came close to ending us all. And of course, Kennan, by the 1950s, as I mentioned in the book, had turned against the very foreign policy that he's associated with of containment of the Soviet Union, and saying we've militarized something we should never have militarized. It's gotten way out of control, and there actually is a political solution with the Soviet Union if we seek it by finding a way essentially to solve the Soviet security challenge of a resurgent German power and economy. Well, that takes us back to issues of a half century ago. But Kennan was not a hardliner, and he thought that we missed real opportunities for making peace, and that the Cold War got extraordinarily dangerously out of hand, something that I subscribe to.
You cite the Libyan intervention of 2011 as a prima facie example of American meddling and propensity for regime change. But isn't it the case that, in fact, the United States was extremely reluctant to become involved in that conflict and only did so at the behest of the British and the French? And indeed, those powers, as well as powers in the Gulf and other European NATO partners, were much more involved in that conflict in the United States?
Well, I think Obama was reluctant. I think Hillary Clinton was enthusiastic. Everything we know tells us that she more or less convinced Obama to go ahead with this. This was a an initiative, if one could put it that way, of the French president, Sarkozy, who decided he wanted to dump Gaddafi. There are many theories why. One of them actually is that Gaddafi was threatening to come forward with the evidence that he had helped fund Sarkozy's presidential campaign. this is widely rumored, though I don't know whether it's true or not. But in any event, this was a French initiative, and Obama was a reluctant warrior in this case, but sent in NATO, and in the end, it was really U.S. Military role in NATO in the air war that ended up toppling the regime. I think it was a vulgar, stupid, costly exercise in gross, internationally illegal power. It's true that it didn't originate in this case with Obama, but it fit this kind of American foreign policy mode, though Obama was usually a hand-wringing, reluctant warrior in this. It's not unlike what happened in Syria as well, where President Obama was not very enthusiastic, but our allies, if you could call it that, Saudi Arabia and Turkey and Israel wanted to overthrow the Syrian regime. And Obama did not want to put troops on the ground, but he did end up signing a presidential finding that ordered the CIA to cooperate with Saudi Arabia and Turkey to provide logistics, weapons, and training to an insurrection to overthrow the Syrian government. Again, completely illegal from an international point of view, and utterly a failure and debacle in the end that created a proxy war in Syria, brought in the Russians, created the space for the radical ISIS offshoot of Al-Qaeda, which was operating there with a lot of Saudi money backing the jihadists. In the end, this is U.S. meddling, a foreign policy that, reluctant or not, says the way you handle a regime you don't like is to try to overthrow it. That's American exceptionalism. Almost no other country could even imagine such a foreign policy, by the way, but this is the norm of American foreign policy. If you don't like them, overthrow them. And you get the drumbeat of war from the Wall Street Journal, which every few months wants to overthrow another country's government. The end result has been 25 years of nonstop violence in the Middle East, no solutions to anything, trillions of dollars spent by the United States, and we're still in this mess with at least some real risk of a new war with Iran, because there are a lot of people in the administration, perhaps the president himself, who would like to see the overthrow of the Iranian regime. And so I don't know how much credit I give President Obama, not very much, for being reluctant in all of this. It's true he was more restrained than a hardcore warrior president would have been, much more restrained. But on the other hand, he took his foot off the brake and let the war machine in both Libya and Syria and continue in Iraq and continue in Afghanistan and continue in many other covert operations throughout the Middle East and North Africa. So I don't give a lot of high points for reluctance in that case.
Without getting bogged down in the intricacies of what happened in Syria, you're not persuaded of the argument that, there was a civil war which broke out in Syria because of the policies of the Assad regime, and that it was in that context that the United States became involved reluctantly and half-heartedly, as opposed to other countries that you cite, particularly Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, who became involved much earlier and much more wholeheartedly.
One of the unfortunate realities of America these days is it's very hard to know everything that really happens, because while we absolutely know of the CIA's operations in Syria with the explicit purpose of overthrowing the Assad regime, we do not have a proper accounting ex post or even continuing of what the heck we've been doing there. So I can't give a definitive answer because we don't know, because we run a secret foreign policy and we run covert wars. So how much, when, exactly which arms went, exactly who was first, not first, it is hard to say. Our mainstream press has done a miserable job on reporting this. 95% of the time they called it a civil war, when obviously it was not a civil war. Obviously it was a war of many regional powers and the United States and Russia. That's not a civil war. And my view is that while there were definitely protests against Assad, we turned what would have been repression into a regional war. That's a big difference. Assad would probably pretty brutally have crushed whatever opposition, and that would not have been pleasant. But instead, we've now had 7 years of mass open bloodshed, hundreds of thousands dead, 10 million displaced. That's worse. And that's what we created by the hubris of saying, as President Obama did in mid-2011, Assad must go. I remember the first time I heard him say it. I thought that is absurd and dangerous. It's absurd because it should not be the business of the United States president to say who must go of other countries' leaders. Second, I thought it was extremely dangerous because I said at the time, and I've said until today, we don't have the power to do it, but it will lead to mass violence. And so it has. And we don't have a proper accounting of it. And we don't even have a proper public understanding of it, because for some reason, we cannot analyze ourselves anymore in this country. And we don't even analyze what we contribute to of these messes. We don't go back to understand Libya. We don't go back to understand Syria. We accept that Iraq was a disaster, but more or less leave it at that. We don't care to have an accounting of how many countries the CIA is operating in right now. We don't have any congressional oversight over any of it. And so we have I would say, not in control foreign policy environment that is absolutely destabilizing and ill-suited to our real needs. And in addition to everything else, a phenomenal distraction from real problems like environmental disasters that are hitting the world, or epidemic diseases that are breaking out and that need to be controlled, or the instability of mass migration, which you should handle at its core of the reasons for it, rather than grabbing kids from parents' arms. So because we're so bad at analyzing any of this right now in a normal public discussion, I feel that the foreign policy is getting more and more deranged. Now it's in the hands of one person that we can't even figure out day to day.
Can you tell the audience why Donald Trump's views, and for that matter, policies on foreign trade, are, to be polite about it, nonsensical?
Donald Trump absolutely understands nothing about foreign trade, but he's fixated on one extraordinarily bad idea, and that is that if the United States runs a trade deficit with another country or with the world, it means that the world is cheating the United States and stealing jobs from the United States. And it's hard to know exactly where to start with this misunderstanding, because what a deficit on our international account means is that we are spending more than we're producing, or to put it another way, we're investing more than we're saving, and therefore we're borrowing from the rest of the world to buy goods from abroad. It has more to do with our low saving rates, our budget deficits, our inability to limit our consumption than it does with any nefarious practices of other countries. But Trump is a kind of paranoid, and he takes this number, which he doesn't understand, and then turns it into a grievance and into a bitter complaint. And this becomes the basis of policy. Now, he's also, in my mind, really weird and difficult to understand individual at the individual level, because he likes show. And perhaps if you just rebrand a few words, things are okay in his mind. So he attacked Canada of all countries and railed against Canada and called the North American Free Trade Agreement the worst agreement ever made. And then, lo and behold, negotiated something that has been rebranded as a U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. And suddenly it's the greatest thing ever because it's got a new name attached to it. So what Trump's views really add up to, more than bluster and show in this regard, I'm afraid I could not give a definitive answer at this point, but his economics are simply worse than one would see in a opening 2 weeks of a trade course.
What, in your opinion, are plausible solutions to the various economic maladies that Donald Trump claims he wants to cure via his trade policies?
We have very high inequality of income and wealth in the United States. And it is true that international trade has probably widened the inequality. It's probably the case that as we open trade with China, for example, 20 years ago, this helped big companies and capitalist owners a lot, and probably hurt workers in the Midwest, the ones that voted for Trump. It's not the only thing that hurt their wages, because automation and technology also played a role. But trade probably had a role. But what Trump absolutely will not see, and it's actually also outside of the vocabulary at the United States at this point, is what the most basic analysis indicates. And that is that whether it's trade with China or other parts of our trade, this has enriched the United States as a whole, but enriched part of the U.S. while hurting other parts. And the answer to such a conundrum is not to stop the trade, but rather to redistribute the gains to some extent. So the normal thing to do in trading with China would be to say, look, our companies, they're not worth trillions. Mr. Bezos and the owners of Apple and so forth, well, they're multi-gazillionaires now, but other people are hurting. We should have a tax system that takes some of those gains and redistributes them so that everybody is benefited from this. That would be the normal way to address this. Instead, Trump gives not only a free pass to the rich, he cuts their taxes. That's his class interest. That's the interest of the funders of the Republican Party in particular, and partly the Democratic Party too. And so instead of redistributing part of the winnings to parts of our country that have been hurt by this, he goes to attack directly China or Mexico or others who he says have been involved in this nefarious evil business. Well, they haven't been involved in evil business, and the solutions lie within our country in a fair fiscal system, meaning both tax and spending. But we're becoming less fair in our fiscal system. Maybe Mexico won't be the object of attack because now Trump has created what he thinks is the most marvelous agreement in the history of the world with Mexico. But he's doubling down, supposedly, on the attack on China as this great nefarious power. Of course, there's another aspect to the attack on China as well that needs to be recognized, and that is that China has simply had the temerity to have so much economic success that it has become a economic counterpart, basically on the scale of the United States itself. And that runs against the American exceptionalist self-understanding. How dare China do that? So Trump, in his attacks on China, mistakes the underlying economics because he should be going after the victors of trade and saying, you contribute more to broad American well-being, but he refuses to do that. He attacks China on multiple exaggerated or completely fallacious grounds, on a trade deficit that has nothing to do with these issues, on China's ostensible cheating, which is phenomenally exaggerated, but easy to do in a nationalist attack mode. And on the foreign policy or geopolitical grounds, where he gets a lot of buy-in in the establishment, that somehow we have to kick China in the knee so that they stop running so fast because they're gaining on us. And all of it, to my mind, is bad economics and dangerous geopolitics.
In the book, there are various quotations put out by the People's Republic in connection with the One Belt, One Road program, which, from what appears in the book, you seem to take at face value. Isn't it the fact, though, that there is a somewhat overt neocolonial hegemonic aspect to the One Belt, One Road program, so much so that it's been attacked recently by the new Malaysian prime minister as well as the new premier of Pakistan? And there were similar protests by African leaders recently about the terms of trade which the PRC enforces on them.
Yeah, it's a good question. China has become a major economic power and a major trade and financial power in the world. And China is doing basically what the United States did vis-a-vis Europe and Central America or South America and Asia in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And that is, it is lending money, building projects, and trying to make the ground hospitable for Chinese multinational companies. And this is what a major economy would do. It is part of China's longer-term development that now that it has reached the levels of economic success, its companies are now investing outward to other parts of the world. And the Chinese government is, in a sense, investing alongside the companies in building infrastructure and making loans and so on. Neocolonialist, I don't think so. If colonialism, to my mind, is power and military power. China has, as far as I know, one overseas military base, a small one in Djibouti. The United States, something like 800. So I don't view this as neocolonial. I view it as what a major economic power would do. Is it a good thing? On the whole, I would say yes, if the quality of the investments that are being made and financed meet the test that they are good investments, they are environmentally sound investments, which is a big deal because this is going to determine the environmental future of a lot of countries, and whether they are fiscally and financially sound investments in the sense that China's not lending money that is going to end up in a major financial crash up in future years. What's happening right now is first that that third criterion is really coming under scrutiny because China lent a lot of money to low-income African countries. And those countries are facing a growing debt right now, and that debt is starting to squeeze. I don't think that that was neocolonialist. I think that that was the operating procedures of the Chinese Export-Import Bank and the Chinese Development Bank. And my recommendation to China all along has been make more grants, make these loans far less commercial and far more concessional. And China heard an earful from the Africans about this recently, as you noted. All fine. Makes sense. I hope that China changes. I'm going to be in Beijing soon to make exactly the same point. The last thing in the world China or Africa needs is an African debt crisis. And I don't think it's China's desire to do that, but it has been their standard operating procedure because these have been loans from banks, not really foreign policy grants. And only now China's actually creating a development assistance agency, the kind that we created a half century ago. China's just now creating, and that will be in advance. Of course, if you're a military strategist who views everything in a zero-sum game, that it's either us or them, this looks alarming. How dare China build the roads, the power plants, the power generation, the port facilities? That's China's neocolonialism. Well, if China starts putting in dozens or hundreds of military bases abroad, we got a very serious problem. Of course, they'd only be emulating what the United States has long done, but I would say we would really have a very, very dangerous world. But that has not been the approach. I think it's unlikely to be the approach. And I think that it's not smart of us to bandy around claims of that this is the same as colonial pretensions. Colonialism was a dark, violent, military-led phenomenon, and it was deeply repressive. The United States has been a party to it for decades by overthrowing governments we don't like and not usually directly conquering other territory, though once in a while, usually trying to rule by proxy. But that's not what China's doing. China's not overthrowing governments like the United States. It's not establishing bases around the world. Right now, it's building its global economic presence. And on the whole, if the investments are good, that's a good thing to do mutually.
How do you see the current situation in North Korea since the Trump-Kim summit?
Well, our president and Chairman Kim are having a love affair, we're told by President Trump. God knows what to make of this man's mind. But what we know is that nothing substantive has changed in regard of North Korea's nuclear capacity. It's got its weapons, and nothing fundamental has changed around that. Trump thinks that it has changed. I prefer this rather than the everyday taunts and declarations that we're going to destroy you in a way never seen before. So if Trump's happy, I have to admit I'm happy because this is just too bizarre. But it's mostly in Trump's imagination, the supposed progress. But I'd rather have that imagination of how much he's in love with Chairman Kim than what we had last year, which was really extremely dangerous. Whether Trump swings at some moment and starts attacking North Korea for not denuclearizing and so on, of course, that can happen too, because the facts on the ground are not as the president portrays them, and probably not as he actually understands them in his own mind. He, I think, probably believes what he says about most things, that he's the greatest, that the new trade agreement with Canada and Mexico is the greatest thing ever, that denuclearization is actively underway in North Korea, and that the nuclear threat is gone, and many other fantasies. But I don't really know for sure what he believes or doesn't believe, or even whether it matters. It is bizarre.
What do you mean by sustainable development?
The idea of sustainable development is the idea that we should try to make a society and economy that works sensibly for all in three ways. One, that in normal economic sense, our standard of living is high. Second, in a social sense, that our society is fair and bringing prosperity to all parts of the society so that no major group in society is left behind or no major region is left behind. And third, that we are managing our energy system and our petrochemical industry and our agriculture industry and our fisheries industry in a way that protects the environment rather than destroys it. So sometimes it's called the triple bottom line: economic, social, and environmental objectives. It's my belief that our economy does only the first of these three things well. We create economic growth pretty successfully, but our society is not fair, and it's become much less fair over time, and we're aggressively endangering the natural environment, and in the case of Trump, gleefully so, because he's the biggest promoter of fossil fuels, which warm the climate and cause all the extreme storms and events that we're experiencing more and more, and because he believes in the freedom of big business to pollute or to destroy the habitat of species at risk and so on. So by sustainable development, I mean that the world as a whole would commit to promoting and sharing prosperity in a way that is environmentally sensible. And this is exactly what the world has agreed to do in two major agreements reached a few years ago, the so-called Sustainable Development Goals and the so-called Paris Climate Agreement. And unfortunately, the U.S. Is basically not caring about either and pretty aggressively trying to torpedo the latter, the climate agreement, because in Trump's view, the most important thing for us is to dig and pump as much coal, oil, and gas as we possibly can and sell as much of it to the rest of the world. A remarkably naive and short-sighted and dangerous idea, but there you have it.
If you wanted people to take one thing away from your book, what would it be?
That we have, with our know-how and our technology and a world now that has a lot of knowledge, literacy, capacity, the chance to create peace and interminable wars and actually solve some of the big challenges that we face, whether environmental or social. And that if we continue on the old idea that international affairs are about American dominance, we're going to end up costing ourselves dearly. More wars, more destruction, even a basic threat to our democracy.
I would like to thank you very much, Professor, for being so kind and speak to us today. This is Charles Cotillo. Thanks for listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you. Great to be with you.